Local News, Culture, and NPR.
From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the Local Edition. Thank you so much for being here with us this evening. I'm your host, Jason Dole. But not for long. I'm about to hand things over to Bill Williams, because it's time once again for the Kingfisher Project, Information Against Addiction, only here on Radio Catskill's Local Edition.
Welcome to the Kingfisher Project, information and awareness about the heroin and opiate epidemic. I'm Julie Pizzol. The Kingfisher Project began in memory of my daughter, Rebecca Jean Pizzol, who was shot and killed due to her heroin addiction. At her memorial service, her former teacher, Mr. Okazalik, read an essay she wrote. It was about a bird, an injured kingfisher bird that she found and rescued when everyone else had given up on the bird. In that spirit, our community came together and formed the Kingfisher Project. Since 2014, we have been raising awareness about the drug and opiate crisis in our listening area and around the country, right here on Radio Catskill. Here is Bill Williams.
Thanks, Julie. If you're listening to this, remember this introduction from Julie, because we're going to refer to it back later in our discussion. My guest today is Thomas Van Norwijk. Thomas, the Nathan A. Greenberg Professor of Classics Emeritus at Oberlin College in Ohio, where he taught from 1974 to 2016. He received a B.A. in History from Stanford, an M.A. in Classics from Yale, and a Ph.D. in Classics from Stanford. He has published scholarly articles on Greek and Latin literature, autobiographical essays, and six books. He was awarded the American Philological Association's Excellence in Teaching Award in 1993 and the 2005 Award for Excellence in Teaching by the Northern Ohio Council on Higher Education. Welcome, Tom.
Thanks, Bill. Good to see you. Thank you for asking me.
42 years, if my math is right. That's a long run.
Yeah, and I loved every minute of it, I have to say. I love my job. I was fine with retiring when the time came, but, you know, I do miss some aspects of it even now.
Do you, did you do any writing after you left the classroom?
Yeah, I actually continued to write things. Luckily, I have some former students who are editors of various publications, and they've invited me to write things. And I've been writing a big long-term project since 2016, interpretive essays on the Iliad and the Odyssey. And they go along with a commentary that's online that helps undergraduates read these poems in Greek. So it's fun for me. I'm mostly using material for my teaching, and I'm very grateful to have this work that my student has offered me.
I don't know whether this comes under full disclosure or not, but in the fall of 1960, Tom and I arrived at the same boarding school where we were roommates, and we've kept in touch ever since, at least in our adult lives. So this is nothing rare. And you may ask, if you're listening, you may ask, well, why are you having a classics professor on a show about addiction? And this gets back to, I would say, the autobiographical essays that the introduction referred to. You have a history of alcohol use in your family, Tom, and let's get to it.
Yes, that's true. I am from what you would call an alcoholic family. The disease has devastated my family for generations, in fact. I know that the Kingfisher Project is is devoted to raising awareness about heroin and opiates and so forth, but I'm just going to talk about alcoholism today because that's all I have personal experience with. I myself am not a recovering alcoholic. I'm not never was afflicted with the disease, but my mother was an alcoholic all of her life. She died in 1987 at the age of 71 from basically because of alcoholism. Her younger brother also died in his 50s from it. In on my mother's side, the disease goes back generations. My mother's grandfather was the mayor of Atlanta, a very successful man who killed himself, supposedly cleaning his gun, but it's pretty clear that he shot himself. And he was an alcoholic, and my grandmother, my mother's mother, found him when she was a little girl. She was the one who found him, and of course, a horrible moment for her, about which I never heard from her. She never spoke about it to me. I only heard later from other family members. But it seems to skip a generation. I mean, I'm not scientifically qualified to talk about alcoholism in a biological sense, but I believe absolutely that it's a disease and that it's it has a genetic origin. And in my family, as I say, my grandmother's, my great grandfather, my mother, and several of her siblings had the disease, and then it skips a generation. My particular generation does not, although lots of us kids, none of us, for one reason or another, got the physical trigger. But then one more generation down, and there have been a couple of my relatives who have succumbed, let's say, one of whom died in his 30s, another of whom I'm delighted to say is alive and well and in recovery. But my mother was married three times, my father was married three times, and every person they were married to was married three times. So that's 27 marriages. And one time I was sitting with a friend and I got a placemat from a restaurant and wrote out all the marriages and circled the alcoholics that I knew about. And there weren't too many names that weren't circled. It's swept through my family in a really, as I say, devastating way. And I myself have been in recovery, as they say, as a member of a family of alcoholics since 1983. So whatever that is, 42 years. No, that's not right. So 32 years. Anyway, a long time. And I'm delighted that more is becoming known about the disease. When I was with you in school, Bill, I had no idea about any of this stuff. All I knew was that my family life was very fraught, very chaotic. When I went to the school that you and I went to, the boarding school, I have said to many people, it kind of saved my life because at home things were completely spinning out of control. My mother had married for a third time to a really sweet, lovely man who was also an alcoholic, and their marriage was decimated by the disease. And by the time it was time for me to go to our school, things were very much in disarray around our house. And I found that being at the school was the thing that kept me going. And the things that I loved about it were the things that horrified all of my fellow students. When I went to Stanford for undergraduate degree, I used to tell my friends about what it was like to be at the school. And, lots and lots of rules. Everything was extremely structured and so forth. That's exactly what I needed because there was nothing like that at home, much to the surprise of all my friends in 1965 in Northern California who couldn't quite see that as the haven that I did. But anyway, that may be more than you wanted to know.
No, not at all. And I'm well aware that your success was academic, that you're able to accomplish a lot in the classroom because of your commitment to what you were doing.
Yes, I definitely would say that was true. And at the time, it felt like a kind of an impulsive choice that I jumped toward being a major in classics at Stanford. Then I jumped at the chance to get into graduate school, which was, in my mind, and in the mind of a lot of others, a real long shot, but it happened. And once I was finished with graduate school, I didn't particularly like it. A lot of people love graduate school and they stay forever. I didn't like it. I wanted to get a job and go to work. I wanted to be a teacher. Once I started teaching, I found the experience of being in the classroom to be exhilarating and nurturing and all the other positive words I could think to say for it. Every year, I got a whole fresh load of smart, bright kids who were eager to know about stuff that I was teaching, who were, very responsive. I mean, it was a wonderful situation. Academic life being what it is, or at least what it was when I was there, you also had to, do certain things in order to stay in your job, to keep tenure. And one of the things you had to do was you had to publish. And that for me was a challenge, learning how to do that. And because I was a late starter, I really wasn't very well prepared in the field. And, I managed to catch up, but it was a lot of work. And when you say commitment, I had to be committed to this 7 days a week, the whole time I was in graduate school. And but once I got in the classroom, I must say I did love my work. And my feeling was that I got so much back from the students that in the end, I would leave the classroom and I would feel more energized than when I went in. It was a wonderful experience. And I had great colleagues, too, about whom I could go on at length. But, once I got my job, I realized I loved my job. I wanted to keep it. I wasn't particularly interested in moving. Oberlin, where Mary and I live, my wife Mary and I live, and where we are now, to me was a great place to live. A small college town. The politics fit me, and there's all sorts of things going on. There was a conservatory of music attached to the college, so there was music. It was a kind of heavenly place to me, and in many ways it still is. So once I got here, I didn't want to leave. But when I came here, I was still completely, really ignorant about the things that were troubling me personally, and almost all can be traced back to my membership in an alcoholic family. Children of alcoholics, that's something that's a subject that's luckily blossomed since the 1970s. I went to work in 74. I started to learn about that in the early 80s, and I started to go to meetings and learn about myself. And what I discovered is that children of alcoholics tend to have certain characteristics that make it very difficult for them to form lasting relationships, intimate relationships. Children of alcoholics tend to guess at what normal is. Everybody else's family looks like the family that you wish yours was. They're the normal people. Why are the people in my family not like that? Also, if you're going to live in that family, and especially if you're a child, it requires a lot of, let's say, deception. I could say lying. I think that adult children learn how to lie, and they often lie when it would be just as easy to tell the truth. And not over important things, but over little things. And particularly, adult children are very, very reticent about sharing their own feelings and telling the truth about themselves because they know they're different. Adult children tend to harbor a lot of shame. And these are characteristics that afflict people who are alcoholics, who have the physical trigger. I mean, my measure of what it's like to be in the family of alcoholics is that in such a family, one person has the disease, has the physical disease, is the addict, but everybody gets it. It's catching. Not in the sense that I was in danger necessarily of becoming someone who couldn't control my drinking, but that all the behavioral characteristics that come along with the disease are adopted by everybody in the family. You can't be in the family unless you essentially play ball. And so you're not well equipped to go out into life and start your own life and start your own relationships and so on, because it turns out that what would work for you at home doesn't work very well in any other relationship. You know, that doesn't make you, a very good partner. You have a lot of trouble with trust issues. And if you can't trust the person you're in a relationship with, they can't trust you, there's no future, I think.
You're listening to the Kingfisher Project on the Local Edition. I'm Bill Williams. After the break, more with my guest, Professor Tom Van Erwijk. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
In many ways, Donald Trump is puncturing the idea that free market capitalism ever existed. He's saying free market capitalism has actually been a myth, that the U.S. government has always been subsidizing all of these businesses in all sorts of different ways. And he's saying, give us something back for it.
I'm Natalie Kitroev. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
Celebrate 35 years of Radio Catskill at the Lou Beach Community House Summer Jubilee. Join us on Saturday, September 13th from 5 to 8 p.m. for live music from Calla Sun and Lolly and the Pops and a DJ set by The Mixtape's Jason Dugoff, plus cold beer from Catskill Brewery. Tickets are $25 and proceeds benefit Radio Catskill. More information at wjffradio.org. The Lou Beach Community House Summer Jubilee, a project of the Beaverkill Valley Land Trust.
Welcome back to the Kingfisher Project on the Local Edition. I'm your host, Bill Williams, and I'm talking with Tom Van Erwijk, Emeritus Professor of Classics at Oberlin College.
One of the things that allowed me to achieve some level of adult maturity is to try to finally realize that I was behaving that way and decide I didn't want to do that anymore. And it was scary because, I found in the past, if I was mad at someone or whatever, it was much better for me to essentially handle the whole dispute in my own head. The other person didn't get to say anything. I would, just assume, well, and then she'll say this, and then, and so I would take care of the whole thing. It means that I never resolved anything. And the other thing is, if you don't observe yourself in genuine disputes, in a certain sense, watch yourself when you're getting in an argument, you don't do the thing that most people do, which is to say, oh, I'm the kind of person who hates to do that. And, oh, but I love this. And it really annoys me when you never make those observations. And in a certain sense, you never come to know yourself. You don't want to know yourself. And again, one of the very often when I'm talking to adult children, we'll say, and we get to the point where we're talking about how we were managed to inching our way out of this black hole that we've been living in. What we were afraid of was not that, if we had to look inside ourselves and learn and be truthful with ourselves about what we were really like, it wasn't so much, at least in my case, I'll say, it wasn't so much that I was worried that I would discover I was a bad person. I probably already believed that anyway. But what I thought when I looked inside is I would see nothing, that I was completely empty inside, because that was often the feeling that you had. And, it's a terrible feeling, believe me. Again, I'd rather be disappointed in myself, proud of myself, all those other things, rather than think I'm an empty shell, which I did many times. And I started to get better in my mid to late 30s. That's when I finally began to be able to do this stuff. But I went all the way through graduate school, and my first marriage without knowing any of this. And you know, to tell you the truth, I'm sure that I damaged a lot of other people. And if you had asked me, I would have said, me? Gee, I'm nice. You know, I only want to help people. I'm friendly, whatever. But in fact, because of my own sort of willful ignorance about myself and about the consequences of my actions, I know that I harmed a lot of people. And I'm happy to say that I was able to circle back and apologize to a lot of those people, but not hardly all of them. I would say that the person that I am now is, to a very large extent, the result of my membership in an alcoholic family and my efforts to counteract the negative effects of that. But alcohol was the ruler in my life, even though I am not an alcoholic. And I never, in college, I drank a lot of beer because I was hoping I could get girls to pay attention to me and so on. But I never drank alcoholically. And if I had had the physical trigger, I believe I'd be dead now. I wouldn't even have lived this long. Because I didn't have that, you know, whatever the genetic marker is that means that when you start to drink, you can't stop drinking. I mean, that's the key. That never happened to me because I often drank too much beer. But then when I went to graduate school, I stopped. But at the same time, I still was a long distance away from understanding about myself.
Can we just for a couple of minutes that we have remaining, switch back to you as a classicist? At the beginning, we heard about the Kingfisher Project. And I'm wondering if the young woman, Rebecca Pazal, who died because of her heroin habit, she was actually murdered. If the Greeks were to reincarnate her or make something out of her circumstance, what would it be? Would they turn her into a kingfisher?
Well, yeah. I mean, you and I talked about this a little bit. I did a little research on kingfishers, and it turns out there's a fairly well-known myth about the kingfisher. The kingfisher in Latin is called Alcyone. That's the name of the young woman, and she and her husband are married and very happily married, but they're a little bit too happy for the gods. They begin to behave in hubristically, arrogantly, and they compare themselves to Zeus and Hera, and that never works. And so they were both killed, right? So the husband is, I think Zeus has a storm coming out on him when he's at sea, and he drowns. And the wife is in horrible shape, and she is very distraught, and she prays to another god, and eventually she is led to the body of her husband. This is washed up on the shore, and she is completely miserable and destroyed, and so she throws herself into the ocean and drowns. So they both die, but the gods take pity on them and turn them into birds. And the bird that they turn them into is a kingfisher, and the name for a kingfisher in a sort of anglicized way is Halcyon. So the phrase Halcyon days has to do with the fact that in the myth, the gods arranged for Alcyone to have a two-week period of completely tranquil weather, 1 week before the winter solstice, 1 week afterwards, when she can make a nest and lay her eggs. And so Halcyon days refers to a period of serenity and tranquility that's arranged by the gods. That's the relationship to kingfisher. I mean, I thought about that, and you know, for one thing, all stories about people being turned into birds, and there are lots of them in Ovid, are really, you know, obviously escape fantasies. You know, you get to the very end, and instead of dying or being destroyed, you're allowed to become a bird and fly off the earth and leave. So in that sense, it's a kind of an escapist myth. Sorry to say, it occurred to me that, you know, there's a connection to drugs and alcohol there, that they look like they're going to be an escape, but they're not. But the myth preserves the, you know, the happy ending and so forth. And the tranquility, maybe that's what happens when you use drugs and alcohol. I'm sure the Greeks didn't think about it that way, but I'm looking at it from where I am, but kind of what the dynamics of the stories seem to say to me. Now, there are lots of other stories in Greek and Latin mythology that are, you know, more reliable guides to how to live a good life, how to be a good person. But frankly, the Kingfisher story isn't one. And I don't mean to, that's in no way a comment on the excellent work that you do and everybody in the Kingfisher Project does. You know, I understand from that story and I see why it happened. But that's what happened. That's the classical antecedent, is Halcyon days.
Well, perhaps we should think of this show, this monthly show, in Rebecca's honor as a Halcyon day every time we go on the air.
Absolutely. I would say that you are a personal Halcyon day for a lot of people, and you're, and the organization too. I mean, I'm very sincere about that. Anything that can be done to help people learn more and have a chance to get a little detachment from this thing that's afflicted them. I don't know. I really admire you, Bill. You know that I admire you and your wife, Margo, for all the work that you've done over the years to raise awareness and so on. Nothing could be more important. And you know, my own personal case, had anybody in my family been able to meet you and be in your programs, you know, 50 years ago, maybe a lot of things would be different. But I don't see how you could spend your time in a more admirable way than what you're doing.
Well, thank you very much. And thank you for your candor and your story, which I am sure will help people. Just so you know, my guest a month ago, we were talking about the prevalence of alcoholism in our listener area. And although the show is more about drugs, or certainly alcohol is the most prevalent drug in the area and the one that gets abused the most and has the most effects on people. So
yeah,
hearing from you today is very, very important. Thank you so much, Tom.
Well, thank you for asking me, Bill. I really appreciate it.
I'm Bill Williams. Thank you so much for listening tonight. There's more to my interview with Professor Tom Van Artwick. Hear our full conversation on the Kingfisher Project podcast at wjffradio.org. You can also find past interviews with great guests, authors, advocates, policymakers, physicians, and those in recovery, all up now at wjffradio.org. And be sure to join me right here next month for a new edition of the Kingfisher Project. Information against addiction, right here on the local edition, only on Radio Catskill.
Big thanks to Bill Williams for doing the Kingfisher Project. Thank you for listening. Do keep on listening on air, always live streaming at wjffradio.org, which is where you can go to hear the rest of that conversation on the Kingfisher Podcast. This has been the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. I'll be back tomorrow evening to do it all over again. Coming up at 7, we've got Music Emporium with Mr. Kusar Grace. But first, it's The Daily. This is Radio Catskill.
Support comes from Sullivan Allies Leading Together, committed to ensuring the safety of our community. Protect those most important by keeping medications in a secure space. Be a part of the solution. More at saltcares.com.
Take a dive into the deep end, the ultimate rock music journey. Deep cuts, live tracks, and rare gems from rock, psychedelia, country, jazz, and blues. Experience the deep cuts on the deep end. Friday nights at 10, only on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.